Hello and welcome to our latest edition of FMI's Built-In Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Winstead, president of FMI Consulting. I'm excited to welcome back Jay Bowman to the podcast today to share his perspective on the 2026 U.S. construction market overview. Over the past few years, the construction industry has enjoyed some meaningful tailwinds, including strong demand, record backlog, and significant investment across a wide range of sectors. But as we move towards 2026, the nature of the conversation is changing. It's becoming less about chasing growth and more about decision-making in a world where volatility, capital discipline, and talent availability and risk are more persistent characteristics of the landscape versus just trends that tend to come and go. This episode is not about predictions for their own sake. It's about stepping back, interpreting what the data is really telling us, and exploring how the strongest leaders are turning insight into better decisions around growth, portfolio balance, and long-term resiliency. And there's no one better suited to have that conversation than my colleague Jay Bowman. Jay's a senior partner in our strategy practice and the head of our market research function. His fingerprints can be seen on many of our market overview and outlook publications. You may also recognize him from our quarterly market outlook videos where he shares his perspective on where we believe the market is headed. Jay is truly one of one. He has a unique ability to see patterns that others miss and, most importantly, connect the dots to help clients make better where to play and how to win decisions. At the risk of dating myself, he's our E.F. Hutton. When he talks, CEOs listen. Jay, thanks again for being here. Welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, we've done this a couple of times, so this should seem like old hat at this point, but similar to last year, it'd be great to do a look back to look forward. So as you think about the last 3 years versus the 3 years ahead, how would you characterize what's changed as it relates to the built environment and more specifically to the construction market? And then what does it reveal in your minds as to where you think the market is headed in 2026?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think it's a timely question as well, because in my opinion, what's changed is that we've moved from what I would describe as a broad, somewhat forgiving expansion to something that's much narrower, more selective market. And what I mean by that is spending isn't collapsing, but it's becoming far more concentrated, as we know. And that makes the headline numbers, I think, less reliable as a guide. So what do I mean by that? So the last few years, when I say they were forgiving, meaning that we had low rates and broad demand, which meant a lot of different strategies worked at somewhat the same time. You didn't really have to be especially precise to grow. But when I say things are changing now, in saying that the market isn't broad anymore, it's just it's being carried by much fewer sectors and I would say fewer geographies as well. So obviously data centers and everything related to that, power, all of those things. So growth is really, it's no longer about staying busy. I'd say it's more about where your exposure really sits, because that's, I think, what I'd say what determines how resilient a business is going forward in the next, say, 3 to 5 years.
We think big market, $2.2 trillion in revenue, various MSAs, various vertical end market sectors. So how do you break all that down? Because I think it's easy to talk over one another when folks talk about the market when they start throwing around numbers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's important to keep in mind that we're still talking about $2.2 trillion industry in total capital or construction spending, currently averaging somewhere around $2.4 trillion between now and the end of the decade. So it's still a huge market in that sense. So I don't want to overstate that there's only some areas that actually still have spending. Because if you look at single family homes, for example, I mean, that's still 18% of spending over the next 5 years. So it's still a large share in that regard. It may not be growing significantly over that time period, but it's still a large share. But if we strip out, let's say, single family homes and take out the improvement, like residential improvements, and really just focus in areas like multifamily, because I do consider that kind of more of a commercial project, our typical non-residential segments and non-building structures. So you're talking still about 17 different segments. You are seeing, I would say, a higher degree of concentration in a few areas. So some of those, again, like I said, I think are the obvious ones like data centers, but I would add in manufacturing or industrials, as well as power. So if you take those three, for example, you're talking almost 40% of construction spending in just three areas, if you will. you add in highway and street and multifamily, and you're close to 50%. So that's what I mean by, you know, you've got this kind of concentrated area of activity, because we've seen a reduction in areas like, you know, warehouse construction over the next couple of years. We've seen reduction in some of the areas like healthcare, for example. So that's what I mean when I say those kind of areas of concentrated spending. Doesn't mean that even those areas that are somewhat less share are not still going to see expansion, just not at the same level of acceleration in these other areas where capital is just flowing at historically high levels. Then from a geographic perspective, you've heard me say this several times before, but there's roughly 400 metropolitan markets in the country. And of that $2.2 trillion that we're talking about, roughly half of it is in 20, 25 of those 400 metropolitan markets. And there we're even seeing shifts. So for example, Dallas-Fort Worth is now the second largest construction market in the country. Los Angeles was the second largest for decades, and this past year is when Dallas-Fort Worth actually replaced them. Again, not that LA is shrinking, it's just growth is concentrating in these fewer areas. Sometimes I feel like a little bit of a broken record when I say, you know, that bulls and bears exist at all times, but that's where the importance is saying, okay, well, if it's $2.2 trillion, that growth and that concentration is going to be uneven. So where will you position potentially manufacture growth for your company in a what we call a relatively flat market over the next 5 years?
Just to build on that, it'd be great to talk a little bit about just the signal versus the noise. So as you step back from the data and look at 2026 through a strategist's lens, you know, what are the one or two signals you think leaders would be wise to take most seriously right now, and why?
The direct answer to your question is that what I hear from other, let's say, senior leaders and the contractors that I've worked with, and even other associations and groups, as well as in the boardrooms, is that the two signals that seem to matter most right now are concentration and constraint. That's probably the best way I could put it. As I mentioned, demand is narrowing. And what we kind of talked about earlier, these constraints are increasingly deciding who can convert that demand into profitable work. When I step back, like I said, demand is really concentrating just those fewer places. So again, power, infrastructure, data centers. But at the same time, those are creating those constraints. So power availability, power sustainability, labor, permitting is becoming more challenging, and even capital in some cases are deciding who can actually execute on a project. And so I think that combination matters, because at that point, averages stop being helpful. So the issue isn't whether work exists. Like we said, it's $2.2 trillion. It's whether you can access and deliver the work that exists without giving back margin or giving out control, again, going back to this concept of concentration and constraint.
So I know that you and I have talked about this before, but a lot of firms are coming off several years of strong backlog and are feeling relatively insulated. Where do you think that sense of stability may be misleading as we head into the next year?
Yeah, it's interesting that you choose the word misleading, because I was actually with a business development leader that wanted a contractor recently, and I thought that she made a really good point here when she told me that it's misleading because backlog is backward looking, that while the risk that firms face in 2026 are forward looking, right? So it's kind of yesterday's success versus, you know, what are we pursuing today? So I think a lot of today's stability comes from backlog that was won under very different conditions. Kind of how we kind of first started talking about the shift from the last 5 years to the next 5 years. And I'm not saying the backlog is real, but again, I say it doesn't really fully reflect today's cost structure, risk profile, or the execution environment that we expect over the next 5 years. So what I see is that pressure doesn't show up all at once. It shows up in specific markets or potentially clients first. And I think that's why firms can feel stable right now up until that point that they aren't. So I think a very useful question, and I would love to say it was, you know, mine, but I've got to give credit to this, again, this particular BD executive that was talking with me about this pose the question that if we had to replace the backlog under today's conditions, would it look the same?
If you were to extrapolate that across a lot of the client conversations that you're having, how would you answer the question?
I would say that it would look very different because my tendency is to go back to, well, why do people build in the first place? And so I think the reasons that people build comes down to really three primary reasons. And the first one is really to exchange a service. So we think of a hospital, school, an airport. They all exist because there's some service that's being exchanged in that building or facility. And the second reason is to facilitate production. So a factory is a simple example, warehouse. I would even consider it data center in that because it is driven by inputs and process and output. And then the third reason is really to achieve a financial return. So think about invested type of construction. So this is a lot of developer driven, but it could be a shopping center, an apartment complex or whatever. And so if we look at through that framework of why people build, like not as construction just being the means to an end for some other industry, rather than putting ourselves at the front of the train, right? Then that's what I mean by I think the backlog would look different because we're looking at conditions in a market 5 years ago where maybe some of those reasons to invest for financial gain might look really different now post-tariff and what we're seeing from just a legislative perspective, what we're seeing from cost of construction and those types of things that shift some of that. And I think that's part of why you're seeing such a huge accelerant in the, let's say, the AI-driven data center world and power, because the reason to build is different than just purely a financial return. Yes, there's a financial aspect to it, but interest rates and tariffs and things are not driving the decision of whether I'm going to go build this $5, $10, $50 billion data center or the supporting power infrastructure, whether that's transmission or even distribution related work to support that.
So when you look across sectors, geographies, and client types, what distinguishes firms that are intentionally shaping their portfolios from those that are simply reacting where the work happens to be at that time?
The main difference is just intentional trade-offs. So firms I work with that I would kind of put under the category of portfolio firms, so multiple offices or geographies, multiple segments, et cetera. The leaders in those firms, you know, how they're thinking about this is really choosing what not to pursue. That's where I'm seeing the difference in the discipline, if you will, versus I'll call them market chasers who are just following whatever's available. So these portfolio-driven firms, what I admire about them is for most of them, they're extremely clear about the work they want and the work they're willing to walk away from. You and I grew up together here at FMI, and I've always really appreciated your view of strategy as it's as much what you say no to as what you say yes to. And I think that's the discipline that we're seeing that becomes a strategic advantage in some of these portfolio-driven firms because they're managing the mix. They're not just managing revenue. Whereas, again, these market chasers, if we want to use that term, they're just going to follow volume wherever it appears. And so that does keep people busy, but it often adds complexity, it adds risk. And most of that isn't fully understood until later and maybe when it's too late.
So then, Jay, how do you see firms recalibrating their risk tolerance and capital deployment decisions as uncertainty becomes more structural than it does cyclical?
Yeah. And I think in past cycles, I'd say that firms assume that uncertainty would eventually ease or stabilize. And today, I think things like tariffs, and the reason I say tariffs, because if you look at the past century, it was marked by low tariffs and all of a sudden they shot up. So it wasn't really the level of the tariffs, it was the rate of change in the tariff. Same thing from the labor availability. So when you go build one of these hyperscale data centers somewhere in the vacuum that it creates in labor. And then even the policy shifts that we're seeing, all these things are becoming relatively persistent. And that's causing, I think, firms to treat capital, as well as I would say leadership attention, as scarce resources, if that makes sense. So I think selectivity is moving earlier before projects are won and not necessarily after. So again, they're becoming more selective because the capital risk are no longer temporary issues. They're really more structural in nature, at least over the next 3 to 5 years.
So just to take advantage, Jay, of how you spend a lot of your time, you spend a lot of time with CEOs, with leadership teams, and in boardrooms. What are the questions, in your opinion, that the strongest CEOs are asking right now that others maybe haven't caught up to yet?
Well, this really gets back to your very first question in our discussion around, you know, where demand is concentrating, maybe where it's subsiding. Many of the CEOs that I admire most, they aren't really debating whether the market is going to be up or down. What they're really asking is, again, that same question that you ask, is where they're concentrated, looking at their exposure as an organization. You know, are we in areas that we can count on? Is the risk exposure, it might look good, but what happens if demand were to subside or even go away completely? And so they're really, I think, stress testing all the assumptions that they've made about their business and where those assumptions would most likely break. Now, that comes into a lot of second and third order thinking. So that includes then not just the financial side of this, meaning like, you know, the revenue and the outcome, but it's around talent. And I think people are even asking like where these assumptions could even break culture. So they're just asking fewer forecasting questions. And again, it's really about exposure. Of course, there is a forecast aspect to it. Like, okay, what in these other areas that we might diversify into, what's the volume of opportunity? How do you access that opportunity? Is that a good fit for us? But it's really based on exposure more so than I think just trying to figure out, well, where are we going to catch the next wave of growth?
Well, it goes back to something I've heard you say before. You know, it's the old adage, just because you can doesn't mean you should. There's a number of firms we work with that could do still probably double every year, come close to it just by doing more data center work, because the clients will give them all they can handle and then some, but then nothing lasts forever, right? Who knows when it's going to slide or slip or do whatever, but nobody wants to be caught flat-footed when that does happen, because you've let atrophy all your capabilities in these other sectors that do prove or may prove to have resiliency long-term as well. And so back to your portfolio logic and how you step through those decisions, the discipline required to do that well is really, really easy to talk about, really, really hard to do when you've got nothing but unlimited backlog staring you in the face.
Oh, yeah. Trust me. I get it. I mean, you and I have been in this industry for 30 some odd years each. And I appreciate the risk that our clients take on. And so when there is something that provides significant, it looks like sustained opportunity, I understand the desire to like, well, let's make hay while the sun shines and go full bore into those areas. And yeah, a lot of the conversations around AI and the resulting data center construction around that. But there's been others that, I mean, it doesn't have to be the headline stuff. I mean, it could be a ton of multifamily work in an area or a ton of healthcare work in a lot of areas. And, you know, we've seen this movie before, Scott. You know, I mean, I think about what you and I were doing a lot, you know, prior to the Great Recession and right thereafter, where a lot of companies got really deep in an area because it was making a ton of money and it was covering overhead and spinning off great returns. And then when that work went away and they were trying to go back to work, maybe they had done before that, the owners were like, well, where were you when I needed you, right? And that's a real problem. Where all of a sudden, you feel like you're starting from scratch. It's not like, oh, we've got this portfolio, we've done this type of work or whatever. Because the attention was so off of that, it really is almost like starting all over again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Shifting a little bit into just optionality, you know, as we head into 2026, where do you think firms should be intentionally preserving their optionality, even if it comes at the expense of short-term efficiency?
Well, this one's pretty easy for me because I've been thinking about this, and I'd say it's three things. It's people, capital, and market exposure. Hands down, to me, those are the three areas where all of these firms need to preserve that optionality, even, like you said, at the expense of efficiency. And I think that's especially where those assumptions, like I said, are being tested and may not hold or may break. And so I think over-optimizing for efficiency can really lock firms into the wrong bets, particularly in a landscape that is shifting, right? I mean, it looks stable, sort of like at the water level, but it is turmoil sort of underneath. And so leaders that can preserve flexibility by, say, pacing their investments, protecting those critical skills, what we were just talking about, staying active in those adjacent markets, not just the growth markets rather than kind of being all in. I think those things are really important, because otherwise what you could find out is you've optimized, but you've optimized yourself into a corner.
It's the supply chain crunch during COVID, right?
Yeah.
If there's zero slack in the system, if you've designed everything for maximum efficiency, then you've got there's no slack. There's no.
It's a perfect analogy. Perfect analogy.
So as always, I really always love talking to you just because of the way your brain works and how you connect dots. I don't want to keep you longer than you have, but I would love to just land on this last question, which would be, if you had to distill everything in our 2026 market overview into one strategic move that leaders should be thinking about, what would that be?
You know, so many of the firms that I've had the distinct pleasure and privilege to serve during my time here at FMI, when these types of market conditions occur, and it's not really the market conditions so much as the shift in market conditions. And you know, we were used to one environment, and all of a sudden now it's a new environment. The question I often pose to them is, well, how old is your firm? And, you know, they'll say, oh, we're 80 years old, we're 100 years old, we're, you know, 150 years old, whatever it may be. And I always remind them that you're extremely successful today. How many of these shifts has your company been through during the lifespan of your company? And then they start rattling them off. And I say, it's not fun, but you found a way to succeed and to adjust to those shifts. And so I try to remind them that in that same sort of line of thinking that you're not really lacking opportunity. What you might be lacking is clarity, which parts of the business still work when power or labor or capital or schedules get tight. But I think once those leaders in those organizations see that clearly, I would say that decisions around growth, decisions around capital and talent, I think they become much calmer and more intentional. So if the market stays uneven longer than we expect, then I think a good question is, which parts of the business are built for that and which are assuming sort of this return to normal? Because we know there typically is no return to normal.
Well, Jay, thanks so much, as always, for being here, for sharing your perspective on the market, where you think things are headed. Always a pleasure, and look forward to having you back again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And to our listeners, we hope today's conversation gives you a clear lens for thinking about growth, portfolio balance, and resiliency in a changing market. Thanks again for joining us on FMI's Built In, and please be sure to like or subscribe so you don't miss an upcoming episode.